You're listening to B2B Revenue Acceleration, a podcast dedicated to helping software executives stay on the cutting edge of sales and marketing in their industry. Let's get into the show.
Looking to grow your pipeline? Download the free SDR handbook from Operatix for insider tips and expert advice on how to launch, grow, and manage a successful sales development team. Head to operatix.net/SDR-handbook/ to download now.
Hi, welcome to B2B Revenue Acceleration. My name is Aurélien Mottier, and I'm here today with Louis Godema, author of Bullseye's Marketing. So first of all, Louis, thank you so much for coming back on the podcast. As we discussed in the preparation, you are here for episode 25. So an early supporter of the B2B Revenue Acceleration podcast. And now you're coming back with your second book, second edition, and we are episode 150. So thank you so much for coming back.
Great to be back talking with you again. And it was great to hear that my first visit was one of your more popular episodes, and hope that people will find this to be a valuable follow-up to it.
It was indeed. People love a little bit of Bullseye Marketing. So today, as I mentioned, we'll be speaking about the second edition of your book, Bullseye Marketing. But before we get started, and for the people that may not have listened to episode 25, would you mind giving a little bit of background to yourself, Louis, for our audience?
Sure. I've been working in marketing for 30 years. Actually, my first job was doing writing when Cabbage Patch Kids were being introduced by Coleco Toys. And Cabbage Patch Kids were the biggest thing ever in that industry. They sold more of those in the first year than the entire doll category the year before. And so for me personally, that was one of those wonderful, you know, you landed in a happy spot because it opened every door for me. You know, that I could say that I worked on that. You know, even if people didn't want to talk to me, they wanted to hear about Cabbage Patch Kids. And so I started to do a lot of work. And in the Boston area in the United States where I live, a lot of the companies are B2B companies. A lot of tech companies have been started around here. And so I worked with primarily B2B and did a lot of work with video marketing, and then opened my own agency in 98. We're working for companies like IBM and other big tech companies. But after the 2002 severe recession, decided I wanted a recurring revenue model and pivoted to a SaaS model before it was called SaaS. We were pretty successful. And I talk about this in the book, the repositioning that was involved with doing that. Sold the company about a dozen years ago, was VP of business development for two marketing agencies before going out on my own again about 10 years ago. So now I am a fractional CMO for startups and B2B startups and tech growth stage companies.
Good. Wow. Far more of experience, Louis. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. So the first edition of Bullseye Marketing was called one of the best marketing book of all time by some of the book authority, shall we say?
Best marketing plan books of all
time. Yeah. That's pretty
that's specific. Yeah.
Yep. Oh, the best marketing plan book of all time. Okay, cool.
One of them. Yes.
Perfect. And I guess we've got the second edition now. So briefly, and you know, from a high level perspective, what can readers expect from the second edition, and how does it differ from the first one?
Well, it's been 5 years, and you know, in marketing, in some senses, nothing ever changes because it's all about understanding the customer and how to communicate and develop products that they're going to want. But in a sense, everything changes. You know, just in the last few months, you know, ChatGPT has exploded onto the world. And even in the last 5 years, other marketing channels have come and gone, and you know, how you use them changes. So that was part of the motivation for writing a second edition of Bullseye Marketing. But this second edition also focuses exclusively on B2B, whereas the first was kind of straddling both chairs of B2B and B2C. And I'm really much more experienced and expert in B2B. And then I think that's where the biggest problem with marketing is. B2C marketers tend to do it better in general. A higher percentage of B2C companies market, whereas a low percentage of B2B companies market to their disadvantage. So I wanted to focus this one just on B2B. You know, there were things that I could do. For example, I had the basic framework of Bullseye Marketing, the three phases, as I did more research and more writing, right? But I had now learned new important research that really supported and validated them. So I wanted to get that in there too. One of the problems, as we'll talk about, with B2B marketing is it tends to be very heavily focused on product marketing. Like a lot of the ads are just like, we have the best product and this is why you should buy it. And it's very bad at brand marketing. And central to successful brand marketing is creativity. So in this edition of the book, I wanted to put in some examples of creative B2B brand marketing so that people could see what I was talking about. And even in the video chapter, I've created a page on the book website, louisgadima.com, which is just examples of videos. Since I couldn't put them in the print version of the book, you can go to that page on louisgadima.com and see a dozen or 15 really good videos from a whole range of B2B companies, including one or two that I've done for my B2B clients that have been very successful and more creative and different from the typical B2B marketing.
Yeah, I agree with you. Less theory, more examples of actually how those things could come into practice, which is super useful. So just pausing for a moment on the three phases, would you mind taking us through the three phases and walk us through each of them and what they mean, please?
Sure. So the first phase is, and you had a guest on a few weeks ago. You had Peter Lorenko, the VP of Demand Gen at HYCU,
right,
who talked about some of this as well. It's about the importance of hitting the ground running.
Yeah.
That if you're going to have a new marketing program or if you're going to transform a marketing program, you have to do things that are going to have an impact quickly. And there are some things that get a lot of buzz, like content marketing, inbound marketing, organic social media, display ads, that can have a great long-term effect, but they don't have a quick short-term effect. And too often if a company is new to marketing, B2B company, that's where they may start because they get so much, buzz around that. And they'll create a bunch of blog posts or videos and they won't get any business results from them in 3 to 6 months. And they'll say, well, we knew it. Marketing doesn't work for us. So instead, in the center of the bullseye, you're taking advantage of what I call marketing assets that any established company has, and even some startups have to a degree, and to optimize those. So for example, get your messaging right so that when people come to your website, they know in 30 seconds what you do, what its value is, who you're selling to. It's not obscure. It's not vague. It's not arty. It's crystal clear. Email list is another marketing asset that companies, don't take advantage of. I'll start to work with a company and I'll say, how many email contacts do you have? And they'll say, oh, we have 10,000 or 20,000. No, how often do you send out an email? Oh, around the holidays, we send a greeting. Email marketing is so inexpensive and so effective. Something else with the website is conversion rate optimization. Get more leads from the people who are coming to your website. And there's several other things like that in the first phase, in the center of the bullseye, where you can have a real impact and generate a lot more leads and opportunities in just 30 to 60 days by taking advantage of these marketing assets that you already have. Then in the second phase, the second ring, the middle ring of the bullseye, is taking advantage of intent data to get in front of people who plan to buy soon. Now, usually that's a small percentage of the market. 95% of our markets, and most people don't think of this, but 95% of the market doesn't want to buy right now. They may want to buy 6 months from now or 2 years from now or whatever. They don't have a priority to buy what you're selling right now, and there's nothing you can do to get them to do that. But there is 5% or so of the market that is planning to buy now. And, can you use intent data such as search marketing to get in front of them and potentially win some deals? And then the outer ring of the bullseye, which in the first book I called Cast a Wider Net, but now I've more accurately called it Build Your Brand and Mental Availability. And I can explain mental availability if you'd like, where you're doing these long-term programs like content marketing and you're building your brand and the likelihood that people will think of you when they do want to buy a year or two from now and put you on their mental short list so that they get in touch with you. And in the long run, that outer ring may be more valuable than the first two combined. But you need to do the first two to set a foundation, establish a foundation, and have those quick wins and success to get the budget and the confidence of the others in your company that they're willing to wait a year or two to see results from some of those long-term programs.
Yeah, it's true. Being an agency that does BDIs, the outsourcing, and you've got a past of working for a marketing agency, so you probably have come across the same challenge, which is you speak to people and when they come to you and they are the 5% who is ready to buy is because they actually need something now. They need result now. They can't really wait 6 months, 12 months, 18 months to get something going. So well, where I'm going with that is, and it's mentioned in the book, so you probably have that that number on top of your head, but what's the right proportion between phase one, phase two, phase three in percentage of budget or percentage of time allocated? And do you see that evolving from a startup to what I would call a scale-up organization? We may not touch too much the kind of the like of IBMs or Google or those very large companies that have probably a different set of problems together, but all the team in the world to support them plus the providers. But do you see the percentage invested in short-term activity versus brand building versus content evolving as the company is evolving? Or do you see, no, it should be 30-30-30 or 50-50? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, the center of the bullseye is something to kind of do and get almost get out of the way, you know, in those first 30, 60 days. Of course, you're going to continue with the email marketing. And, you know, I talk about account-based marketing as an ongoing way to collaborate with sales, between sales and marketing, and some of those programs. But basically, I'm relying on the research here, famous report from the UK's IAP, Les Bennett and Peter Field, called The Long and the Short of It, which has really become essentially a classic in the last 10 years. And they talk about in the long run, you want to have for a mature company, a mature B2B company, generally about a 50-50 balance between brand and lead generation, or as I guess you sometimes call it, activation. But for a startup, you probably want to make it more like 2/3 lead gen and 1/3 brand. You know what a big mistake startups make is they only focus on lead gen. They don't focus on building their brand. And if they want to be around for the long run, they need to do both. But they do have a lot more urgency around lead gen and, you know, creating opportunities and closing deals because they don't have the financial depth that an established company that's been around for 20 years has. And so they need to put a heavier emphasis on lead gen to get a deeper penetration in that 5% that wants to buy now. And for many B2B startups, those first few wins, you know, the first 10 or 20 or 30 are usually going to be from direct outreach, from a BDR, from their network with people they know. But then marketing kicks in. And so if you only want where your market only has, you know, 30, 50, 100 opportunities, you don't need a lot of marketing for that because, you know, you just need a phone. You can reach those people. But if your market has thousands and tens of thousands of potential customers, then you do need marketing to build that brand and that mental availability.
No, great. I agree. And you mentioned recession in your intro. I think you mentioned 2002 when you decided to make some changes. We are supposedly in a recession right now. We kind of banned the word recession from our vocabulary because it's too much. It's everybody, TV, radio, everybody think about it. But how do you rebalance those three phases? It almost seems to me that when times are becoming a little bit more difficult, people almost go back to phase one and phase two. At the same time, I think building a brand when times are difficult out there could also be a great strategy.
Totally. A recession is a great time to grab market share. And so that, you know, a lot of companies, marketing is often the first cut, the last restored in a recession. And it's a big mistake because, you know, time and time again, studies have shown that the companies that keep marketing through a recession come out with bigger market share. And often it's less expensive to market during a recession because for the marketing platforms, the ones that are charging for clicks and impressions and so forth, if their revenue is down, often your costs to use them is down. There's less competition for some of the keywords. There's less competition to get into that trade publication and so forth. So a recession is not a time to cut your marketing. It's a time to really see it as an opportunity to get a jump on the competition and come out with a bigger market share.
Yeah, I think we've seen that ourselves over the COVID breakout. So 2019, so we decided to keep on investing in marketing, and you are completely right. Google advertisement was cheaper. So we're like, look, let's do a little bit more of it. And I think that's kind of relating to the other points you are making about the 95%. It's not because 95% of the people are not ready to buy that you should not interact with them. And I think a recession or when times are a little bit more difficult. So COVID was a little bit, you know, pandemic is a new one, technically. Mm-hmm. Not a new one historically, but a new one technically for us now in the new world of living with Twitter, Instagram, and all those way of communication. And what happened is that literally from one day to the other, you may have 10 people in your pipeline, and the next day you've got five, because five of them have budget freeze or they can't do something. Doesn't mean that they don't want to work with you. It means that they don't have the means to work with you now. Mm-hmm. And what we should also know, been through a couple of our time, 2008, 2010, myself as a professional, COVID obviously, and more recently Q4, Q1 that were a little bit soft last year and this year, is after a period of recession, there is always a good period of reinvestment where the money is flowing and people are actually doing things. And unfortunately, the companies that are letting their marketing go, letting their marketing supplier go, letting their BDI, SDR team go, they are missing on that opportunity, because when they will re-engage and start investing again, they would have other companies that would have invested in having conversation and interaction with the market when the time was difficult, potentially to help them or potentially to educate them. So when things are coming back to normal, you are more likely to speak to the company that is top of mind, the people who have been speaking to you over the pandemic or over the recession, and more likely to get the services. So it actually makes sense. But again, I think it's almost like it feels that when there is pressure on sales, we almost go back to the delivering the tactical stuff versus the more strategic things. But I do agree with you that brand is super critical. Coming back to that point again, one last time on phase three, which is building the brand and staying on top of mind. There is an example in your book, I believe, with the CMO of Gusto, or one of the former CMO of Gusto, regarding CAC. So the cost of acquisition of clients and brand building, and what happened when she stopped building brand. Would you mind just taking us through that example? Because I think when I read it, I saw it was quite powerful, because it's someone who's done it, stopped doing it, and actually realized the impact of stopping doing something that is working. When I think a lot of people listening to the podcast today are trying to work out what would be working for them in the future, I think it's almost good to learn from the lesson from others. And that's what I like about your book as well. It's all those little nuggets of example of people who have tried something, may have failed into something, and make a decision to start again. So if you could take us through that. Great.
So that's Jalay Rezai, who was the CMO of Gusto when they grew from 500 customers to 50,000. Now, she had a huge budget. Gusto raised, you know, a huge amount of money to help do this, but she used it obviously very well. They were very successful. There are other companies who have raised money that haven't been successful. And she makes the point, I quote her a few times in the book, and she makes the point, this was a post she put on LinkedIn a few months ago, where she said, talked about the importance of brand marketing for startups. And she said that when she was at Gusto, she had all these award-winning brand campaigns and so forth. And she said, you know, they didn't bring in many leads at all. But whenever she would turn them off, 6 months later, their customer acquisition cost, their CAC, would go through the roof, because their performance marketing became much less efficient because the brand had diminished from lack of support. And so she strongly recommended spending at least 10 to 20%. She said that was a minimum that she thought a startup should spend on brand. And so this is one of the important things, is that brand supports your BDRs. Brand supports direct response. Direct response does not build your brand. You know, having an ad for download our white paper or sign up for a webinar or 10% off does not build your brand. But brand does make your performance marketing much more effective, because people are just much more likely to engage with a pay-per-click ad from a company they know than from one that they don't. Yeah. So yeah, she saw a huge return for a startup in brand marketing.
You also use another analogy about, I think it's well-being, the analogy that you use. So, if I remember correctly, you're kind of saying if you go to the gym 30 minutes per day, every day on a consistent basis, that's pretty much doing the brand marketing. So you keep on going and you do it for a period of time with small bursts over a period of time, which is good for your health versus taking a COVID jab or doing some other things that are like a one-off things that you do to feel better. They may not make you feel good in 1 year, 2 years from now. When I read that, I found that quite interesting because it's very much the conversation that I'm having sometimes with early stage CEOs or early stage CFOs, where everything needs to be linked to not immediate results, but maybe results in the next 3 to 6 months. And I think in the book, you're very clear that brand should take around 1 year, 2 years, 3 years to really flourish and give you the results that you would want it to provide to you. So for all the marketing people that are listening to us today and may be frustrated that in their organization, the leadership team is not understanding the power of brands and building a strong brand for the future to keep on the growth of the business, what would be the advice you would give them so they can have some ammunition and re-engage with their leadership and start to say, okay, we need to plant the tree now. And I know the tree won't be big. I know the tree won't give us fruits for the next 2 to 3 years, but the best time to plant the tree was 20 years ago. The next time is today. So what advice would you give them? Because we see a lot of frustration around that when we speak to marketers. We want to do better things, brand things, but they always kind of get pushed back towards the corner of we need results now, we need ROI.
Yeah, and this is sometimes, you know, called short-termism. And because in the last 10 years, you've had this explosion of marketing technology, you know, CRMs, marketing automation programs, social media marketing programs, email, et cetera, they all collect data, they all have analytics. And I actually have a chapter which is very contrarian on a lot of the data and analytics, marketing analytics, because a lot of them are a lot less reliable than people want them to be. You know, when I'm working with a company, you know, I was telling this company over and over again, email open rates don't mean anything. They're really just a total fiction. You know, it's based on a pixel, you know, people open it and it doesn't get reported. People don't open it and it does get reported, you know, ignore. And, but they're like, no, we, you know, you're just trying to get out of it. Be responsible for this. And then they set out one time a email campaign and 50 people at Microsoft opened it. And they're like, oh my God, this is great. You know, and the sales people on Monday, they were all over Microsoft and they couldn't find a single person who remembered opening it, but the Microsoft spam filter had opened it. And so, you know, there's a lot of data in marketing, especially campaign data, that's not useful. Mm. But because this data exists, there's this focus on these short-term results. And the only results you should care about are real verified leads and opportunities and sales. You know, of course, you're going to use campaign data to try to optimize your campaigns to the degree you can. But it's that short-termism that's a real problem. And the problem with brand marketing, though, is it's hard to measure. People think the short term is always easy to measure, not always as much. I also talk in the book about the cannibalization effect, that, you know, the companies that have turned off literally 100% of their Facebook ads and seen no decline in sales through Facebook. These are usually B2C companies or app companies. And it turned out that people who were going to buy anyway just were clicking on the ad rather than just going direct, but they were going to buy anyway. And P&G, I think, cut their digital advertising by 50% without any decline by targeting it much better. So there's this problem with short-termism. But as you were saying, the analogy that I make is about for brand marketing and lead gen marketing is to health and exercise. And 30 minutes a day of exercise is well known to produce much better health in the long run and much better wellness. But you can't say, oh, I went to the gym last Tuesday or I ran, you know, 5K last Tuesday and that's what made me healthy. You know, it's doing it week after week, month after month, year after year that has that effect. And that's like brand marketing. And lead gen marketing is like getting the COVID jab or the, you know, the stent if you have a heart attack or, you know, surgery or chemotherapy if you have cancer. It keeps you alive. It can be critical. but by itself, it does not produce long-term health and wellness. You need both, just as you need both the brand and the lead gen in the B2B world. There's a great ad in the print chapter of my, when I'm showing some great print creative. There's an ad from 50 years ago that McGraw-Hill did when it was a publisher of B2B magazines. And it was an ad for B2B marketing. So 50 years ago in the chapter on print, I include an ad that's a classic from McGraw-Hill when they were publishing B2B business magazines. And it's an ad where you see this kind of stern-looking man looking at, straight at you in his chair at his desk. And he's saying, I don't know who you are. I don't know your company. I don't know your company's product. I don't know what your company stands for. I don't know your company's customers. I don't know your company's record. I don't know your company's reputation. Now, what was it you wanted to sell me? You know, and it's an ad for brand marketing. It's an ad for B2B marketing, advertising. And it's a great example of how, you know, a brand supports your BDRs, that if someone is known when they call, they're going to be much more effective.
Oh, yeah, 100%. And we see that with our clients. Sometimes we represent companies that are coming out of stealth, literally not known whatsoever by no one. Then you've got the cool kids. That would be the company that just got like 200, 300, 4 million of investment in their first round. And everybody speak about it as, wow, it's the next unicorn or whatever. And then we work with the like of IBM and Google and all those big brands. And when you have a big brand, I think it's almost like a double-edged sword, because if I say Google, would you think about cybersecurity? Maybe not straight away, but Google actually do a lot of cybersecurity. If I say Oracle, would you think cloud offering? Maybe not straight away. You may think about other things that Oracle is doing. So it's kind of an interesting one, because the brands almost give you, if you are a BDR SDR on the phone, it gives you a minute to explain what you're on about, but you still need to be good after that. Well, it becomes a bit tricky, that with brand can come sometimes prejudice or preconceived ideas or non-spoken objection. Because if I say W, you're probably thinking cars, but you may not think about the bikes that are winning the Paris-Dakar, and they have great motorbikes that can go very quick on the sand. But you would not associate BMW potentially with those guys. And I think this is the association that people are making. But it's interesting when you go with a brand, then you go and break that and say, well, I know, Louis, that you're thinking about this, but that's not actually what I want to talk about today. I want to talk about the new things we are doing and what we see the future and all the investment we've made in that space. But the brand really helps to get the conversation going. When you just have a name of a startup that is just a small startup, I think the prospect almost wants you to give me the name of a brand I can associate you with so I know who you are, right? You know, they may not just even want to know about the category that Gartner puts you in or Forrester puts you in, but it's good to say, hey, we are helping with video content. So if you look at what Vidyard is doing, it's kind of Vidyard, but we do that on top of it. Okay. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting how people associate things in their heads. You almost need to help them to find out, how do you position yourself? So what to compare you with, and then what makes you better, and why me? Why do you want to talk to me? But definitely our clients who are doing more of an effort in building a brand, being more visible, get better results. So 100% with you on this one. Unfortunately, we're getting to the end of the episode today. So I want to thank you so much, Louis. But most importantly, I think your book is really good. And where can people find it? Give us all the places where we can find you also, Louis. I just want to make sure that for most of our audience who have listened to us today and took great interest in the conversation, they should definitely read the book. There is lots of practical tips. There is lots of it's research based as well. It's not just, you know, your theory and you in front of a whiteboard saying if the world was perfect, this is how it would be. You actually have some proper research behind it. So how can we find you and your book, Louis? What's the best way?
Yeah, well, I try to combine a lot of real world examples with the research. It's not just data points, but it has some validity across hundreds of companies, many different industries. So thank you. Yeah. So you can find it, you know, go to Amazon and you'll find it there. And if your local bookseller is not carrying it, tell them they should be. but you can find it, you know, ebook, hardback, audiobook on Amazon.
Is it an Audible that you've got on Amazon? Or
if it's not there now, it will be very shortly. The audiobook may be just a few weeks later. And I actually, almost everything I read, like 95%, I listen on Audible or there's an app, Libby, where I get books from audiobooks from my library. So that's the way I do a lot of my reading. So yeah, you'll find it in every format. And I hope that people will, you know, take a look at it. You can go to louisgadima.com and find out a lot more information about it. Hear a great foreword that Douglas Burdett, the host of the Marketing Book Podcast, wrote for this edition. See some endorsements from some other well-known marketing leaders. So check that out and hope to hear from you. I'm available on LinkedIn and Twitter.
Thank you so much, Louis. It was a great pleasure to have you on the show today. Thanks again.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
You've been listening to B2B Revenue Acceleration. To ensure that you never miss an episode, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast player. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.
Looking to grow your pipeline? Download the free SDR handbook from Operatix for insider tips and expert advice on how to launch, grow, and manage a successful sales development team. Head to operatix.net/SDR-handbook/ to download now.